Hello, and welcome to this edition of the Fair Data Podcast, where we discuss all things fair, making data, and today, making software, findable, accessible, interoperable, and reusable. I'm Rory McNeil, host of the Fair Data Podcast, and my guest today is Michael Crusoe. Among other things, Michael is co-founder and project lead of the Common Workflow Language Project. This is a special edition of the podcast, coming out in conjunction with the 10th anniversary celebration of the RDA. Each month in 2023 has a theme. February's theme is software and workflows, and there can't be a better person to talk about that than Michael. Michael, welcome. It's great to have you on the podcast.
Thanks, Rory. It's a real pleasure.
So you have a non-traditional academic career with a degree in microbiology and a background in IT. Tell us a bit about how your interest in both of those subjects developed.
Yeah, my career is kind of funny. I wouldn't recommend to anybody else, but it's worked out for me. So I was an IT, the computer systems student at Arizona State University and hadn't figured out my life, dropped out, worked in industry for a long time in IT, even for some quite big companies. When I came back to go back to college and finish my bachelor's, I was pretty burnt out on IT and computers. But I kept my mind open and I took a really fantastic biology course at a community college. And I was like, wow, you know, reverse engineering billions of years of evolution. I don't think I'll get bored with this. And I dove into to biology and then into microbiology and eventually got my bachelor's in microbiology from Arizona State. But I was still, you know, the computer guy, but I was trying to really dive deep into the life sciences and understanding these systems and the tools and techniques we have to learn about them and to piece together this chaos that is life.
And at that point, did you see any connection between the two, or were they kind of just two separate interests?
Yeah, I just wanted a big change in my life. So I kind of closed the door to my IT background, though lots of people were looking at me as like, we're going to go into bioinformatics, right? And I was like, no, that's not for me. I'm done with that. I want to, you know, I was enjoying my molecular techniques. And of course, immediately upon finishing my classes, I took a job as the pet bioinformatician in a vertebrate lab. There's a famous blog post from many years back about this concept of the pet bioinformatician. Mick, what's his name? And you should edit that out, sorry. I definitely was that pet bioinformatician. The computer guy in the lab full of vertebrate researchers. But it was a great crash course into bioinformatics, and I realized how much of my IT background was a huge asset. You know, this was a decade and a half ago, and so, you know, life was just harder dealing with all the different types of software. Getting them installed was quite difficult for a lot of people. But for me, in my background with Linux and Unix, was not so bad. It was a complexity I could handle. But I also hurt because seeing all the pain and agony my colleagues went through dealing with the software problems, knowing it could be better, motivated me to look in that direction of, well, I can take my domain experience in microbiology and knowing how to talk with these people and what they do. And really, I think I can maybe actually have a bigger impact on the IT side. And that has luckily proven out to be true. And I'm really proud of the impact I've made so far. And I'm hopeful to make more positive contributions to bridging that gap. I think a lot of IT people get scared, though, of the complexity of the life sciences. And so it was kind of nice that I had that sort of reverse experience.
That's really interesting. Yeah, it's kind of a bottom-up, not a bottom-up approach, but a bottom-up experience to first of all, to discovering the gap. I mean, it's certainly something that obviously you come across all the time is the gap between the computationalists and the kind of long tail of non-computational biologists. And frankly, a lot of computationalists seem to just wish that the non-computationalists didn't exist, or whereas you seem to be much more sympathetic to where they're coming from, which, and that kind of empathy, I would say, it seems to me, must have been a huge, it sounds like it was a driver in the direction that you took. And I think it's also a huge a benefit, and also enables you to make that contribution as you described. So let's, I guess, fast forward a little bit. So eventually, how did this then lead to your thinking about what became known as the Common Workflow Language?
Yeah. So after some time in Kenro Kasumi's lab, the vertebrate lizard lab, I took my next position in Michigan State University, working for C. Titus Brown as the staff software engineer in a small bioinformatics group. And both in my time working with Dr. Kasumi and Dr. Brown, I had the experience of, you know, the bioinformatician, the best practitioner, right? And maybe a common experience for some in this area is, you know, you read a great paper, and, you know, I was in a lizard lab, but read a great paper from some mouse researchers, and, oh, what a cool RNA-seq technique they're using. I want to use that technique, but with our data. And maybe even if I was still working with mouse data, you know, life is just going to be different. Every time you run analysis, you need to make changes. You need to really both know what they did to understand that sort of base ground truth of their experiences. And then you're going to need to adapt it to your own data and the own parameters of your research. And like many did at the time, and fortunately still do, I ran up into that problem of the incomplete description in the literature of what was done with the computers, right? So in the life sciences, we're pretty good about keeping notes in our lab notebooks about what we do in the lab and our molecular techniques and the behavioral studies. But when it comes to the computer side, we don't have that discipline. And frankly, if the tooling didn't exist and the norms around sharing those details of exactly which program, which version, maybe a snapshot of that, what were the exact commands you ran? And in bioinformatics, we tend to use tools written by many different labs, codes from many different groups in many different languages. And we'll often have some complexity challenges there. And so you also need to know what order the tools were in. You might use a tool multiple times in different ways. So all those connectivity together, that's called a workflow. Even if you did it manually over time, piece by piece, but we can represent that whole thing as a workflow. Maybe if it's an automated workflow, we can rerun that. So that was my introduction to both the problem and the frustration of the literature being incomplete. You know, people talk about the reproducibility crisis. I feel that the bigger one is the reusability. Strict reproducibility is sort of academically interesting, but the researchers want to reuse their own work and others' work. And I felt that pain as well. So working for Titus, you know, we were a software lab. We had a grant to make our software available through a web service. And we didn't want to build a whole new web service framework, right? We looked at, well, who's the biggest bioinformatic web service workflow system? Well, that's Galaxy, right? The Galaxy workflow system is probably the largest scientific workflow system community I know of. They regularly get over 200 people a year at their conferences. Which for a workflow-specific conference is huge. And they've been doing this for a long time, and they've been sustaining their work. So I did the work of bringing our lab's tools to the Galaxy platform. It's a great platform. I'm a big fan of it. But it was a lot of work. And then I learned about all the other workflow systems that were out there. Since about that period, I started a list where people can add scientific workflow systems that they've learned about. And we're at over 300 used in research. So 300 different systems, different ways. And prior to the Common Workflow Language project, none of those systems could talk to each other. None of those systems you could take your workflow that you wrote in one and use it in another. So these are all the pieces that came together. It was a lot of work, though worth it, to get our tools integrated into Galaxy. We wanted to share that work for other contexts, but there was no standard for doing this. for the tools themselves, how the tools work, and then let alone a standard for describing the workflows. So this all came together in the summer of 2014. I was at two conferences back to back. First, the Galaxy Community Conference, where I got to know their developers. And I met in person John Chilton, one of the C2L co-founders. And he also shared that desire to have a standard so that things that were built for Galaxy weren't good just for the Galaxy users. But, you know, he and many other Galaxy developers want to share the development work as much as they can with other groups and domains. And then at the Bioinformatics Open Source Conference, run by the Open Bioinformatics Foundation, they had a code fest. And so John and I brought this topic up, and there were two other people there, our two other co-founders, Boyce Janik and Peter Amstutz, both from industry, who also had this desire to have a standard. And so, you know, we came together, four engineers at a whiteboard and at a code fest, and said, well, let's just talk about this. Let's see what our goals are. What could we build together? And, you know, how bad of an idea could it be, right? And here I am 10 years later. It turned out to be a pretty good idea, it seems. Got a lot of usage. And we made a standard that not only works, right? So it achieves the goals. You can describe your workflow using CWL. Especially if you add software containers, your workflow is portable. You can write that workflow on your laptop, run it on your workstation, run it on the cluster at your university or institute, or send it to the cloud. And now there's implementations, you know, both academic, commercial, open source, proprietary. And now we're seeing usage even outside of bioinformatics.
So, yeah, so that's really, again, a very logical, in retrospect, a very logical development. But like all ideas, it probably was, I imagine, it was a lot of work to formulate the idea and then get it off the ground. You made it sound simple, but I'm sure it wasn't that simple. But so if you could just maybe, keeping in mind that we obviously our listeners on the podcast, we have some technical listeners, but we also have a lot of people who really aren't very, very technical. Could you take a stab at, and you've just done that a little bit, but maybe kind of going over again and just confirming for people what CWL is at kind of at a high level.
Yep.
And then also give us an update on where the project stands and what you see kind of coming in the future.
Yeah, so I hinted a bit at what how we view workflows, right? This automated execution of components. And we do really care about in the service of research and science, though we have users of CWL outside of that. And for CWL specializes in workflows that are made up of command line tools. Because in bioinformatics, right, you may have heard me talk about that we had tools written in many different programming languages, Python, C, Ruby, Perl, R. And if you want to coordinate and share data between those, you're going to work at the command line. So the big empty box, the terminal, right? So CWL is a standard that targets this type of workflow. It's an open and free standard. So it's free to use and implement. It's openly licensed. And it's free to participate in the process. We're not a pay-to-play standards organization. You don't have to convince your country to vote in a certain way. People come and show up and participate. We have a formal governance structure, and as a project, we're owned by the Software Freedom Conservancy, a US-based public interest charity that's legally obligated to work in the public interest. They also own projects like Git. So we have a mature governance structure, we're independent, we work in the public interest, and we provide this standard to help researchers describe how they use the computers in their research to other researchers.
Could you give us sorry to interrupt. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. So just briefly, the CWL standards now are at version 1.2. And I mentioned that they are implemented by many different workflow systems. And now we have also seen adoption in geospatial, earth observation, high energy physics, radio astronomy, hydrology, and other fields who have needs that are similar. CWL is not for single language workflows. And so there are a lot of workflow technologies and frameworks where everyone's writing in the same programming language or the same framework. And that's great. We're not for that. And you asked maybe a bit about our future plans. We're working on CBL 1.3. And we're looking to incorporate the community extensions for specialized hardware like GPUs, along with workflow level loops. And with the support of Elixir and others, we're improving and growing our training materials and reference documentation.
Great. Okay. Well, you mentioned Elixir. That's I know you're active in a couple of countries of the Elixir activities, and I think you said when we were chatting earlier in the Netherlands and Germany. So, does CWL, and if so, how does it fit into the more general interoperability work going on at Elixir?
Yeah, I think the design of CWL inherits from some projects that Elixir and their institutes were involved in the past, like WF Forever and others, also learning from the experiences of the Taverna system out of Manchester and other institutes. And so while we don't really expose this to users, under the hood, CBL heavily supports the use of linked data and other identifier-driven interoperability techniques. As an example of this, a couple of years ago, we wrote the CWL prov profile for making an RO bundle, which is a collection of the outputs of a workflow and the provenance of how that workflow is executed, showing how the existing provenance standards and the linked data underlying nature of CWL really connect it well together. So in Elixir, and participants outside of Elixir have now taken this CWL prov and are making a new standard called the workflow run profile. And this is part of the RO create, the research object create framework. So this is a workflow language and domain agnostic standard for saying, here's the results of a workflow. Here's the provenance of the execution of that workflow. So the exact technical details of how that happened. And then because it's RO create, you can always include all that other domain specific provenance and metadata that's applicable for your analysis. So the Elixir work with CWL in the interoperability side is really about this sort of linked data story, right? Well, linked data is how we will make FAIR happen, right? And so it's really nice to kind of show that effort in concert so we can get that end-to-end linked data. So you can share that complete story of what happened and also credit who was involved, which institutions and instruments and compute facilities. And I'm really excited about that. I love giving people credit and money, right? And one helps the other.
Excellent. Okay, I want to come back to a couple of those things in a minute. So that's really interesting, really interesting. But for the moment, let's zoom out a bit. So the research software data bioinformatics worlds in Europe are increasingly, or maybe already, primarily operating in EOSC-driven and EOSC-funded, either directly or indirectly, environment. And there's so much going on within EOSC that it's impossible for me, and I suspect anyone, to even pretend to keep in touch with everything that's happening. But are there particular EOSC projects that are relevant to CWL, that are adopting CWL, that people that you're working with?
Yeah, I've certainly EOSC Life with the Workflow Hub, I think, has had a huge impact. Workflow Hub is a domain and workflow system agnostic place to publish and promote workflows, both so-called finished workflows, which I think no workflow is truly finished, and also in development ones. But looking forward to some of the projects, I would say the direction I hope to see EOSC moving in, I think we'll see more use of CWL to directly engage, to both, one, directly engage researchers, providing workflow execution as a service. You know, currently, if you want to do computing as a researcher, you have to evaluate, you know, local resources, national and regional resources, to figure out which infrastructure you want to run on. probably have to fill out a form for each of them separately, and really have to make a lot of decisions. But with a standard like CWL and using software containers, you shouldn't have to make that choice about where to run your workflow. You should be able to hand that off to a system, and they should just go do the smart thing. Run it nearby if the data is big. Run it someplace else if that's going to be cheaper. And of course, give credit to the appropriate institutions providing that support. So this workflow execution as a service feature, I feel, is something I hope to see the EOS projects tackling. On the other hand, I also hope to see more behind-the-scenes use of CWL by like scientific gateways and other research web services. You know, those are great. You've got experts curating analysis and databases. You can give a specific query as a researcher using the language you understand. They're going to run that analysis for you, you know, for free at time of delivery, and you get a result. But if they use CWL, they'll have a bit more portability in their infrastructure. And they can also report back to the user, here's the exact workflow we did run for you. So now you have that reproducibility, reusability aspect. And maybe we also give you better provenance data. So those are the two areas in EOS I hope to see coming. But like you, there's so many projects, I can't keep track of them all.
Yeah, okay, that's really interesting too. So as you mentioned at the start of the conversation, until fairly recently, you were based in the U.S. and worked at a number of institutions before you moved to Berlin. I know this is a big question, but given your transatlantic perspective, could you shed any comparative light on common standards software, research software, on developments in the U.S. and Europe in terms of things like funding, organization, institutional support? What are your observations after having been in Berlin for a few years?
Yeah, I've been in Berlin since 2019 and in Europe altogether for almost 8 years. So maybe I'm getting a little out of touch from the U.S. But there is institutionally and at higher levels a stronger commitment in Europe to standards and building things together. This is a geographic, geopolitical reality. I don't think people and institutions in the U.S. are against this, but you just have a need for it in Europe, given the history and borders and languages for this, that you don't have in the United States. And so it's been a real joy to find Elixir, this pan-European data for life science bioinformatics network, because they exist a people who care quite a lot about standards, about building things together when it makes sense so we can go further, and who are funded to do this work. And in the U.S., I know many people who care about this, but the funding situation for building that historically has not been so good. It's been getting better. I've seen this both in the NSF and the NIH, and we now actually see our American colleagues here in Europe learning from our work, and we also continue to learn from them. And so it's nice to see the increased engagement. But historically, we do see more in Europe, and there's just been a more appreciation for that. One of the first countries to really use CWL and engage with me was actually the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. And I was like, somehow this makes sense, right? A country who has a historic connection to maintaining infrastructure because lives depend upon it. You know, and I think there's many such stories in Europe about standards and working together mattering a bit more. It's a bit more urgent here. Just like, why are the life sciences seemingly doing more in some areas about FAIR and interoperability? We have more complexity and more researchers. There's more people to coordinate.
Yeah, very interesting. So I'm trying to, what are the, like in the US you have NIST, obviously is a standards focused organization, but it seems to me that also one of the differences, it's funny. I mean, in many ways, EOS and all the stuff that it's driving, it's very top down. It is very top down, but maybe because of that complexity and diversity of cultures and jurisdictions and geographies that you mentioned, it requires bottom up work and coordination. And that's, that has some very fruitful consequences, as you've been describing. Whereas in the US, I'm actually less familiar with the US too, but it seems to me you have the NSF, the NIH, NIST. These are all like kind of top-down organizations, and they all have a, you know, it's as if they're zooming down in a particular silo, but you don't get the kind of cross-connectivity that you described in Europe. And therefore, you tend to get, it seems to me anyway, that some of the standards that are developed by the likes of NIST are not necessarily widely adopted, because the communities haven't really been that involved in their, I'm probably sounding critical, but, you know, haven't been that involved in their development. Whereas in Europe, the standards don't develop without the community development. Do you think that's a fair statement?
Yeah, there are several different models of standards building. So the classic old school one, right, is like ISO. Countries make standards within themselves, and then eventually they come together through the ISO to make a standard, and each country gets one vote. And there is a world in which that made sense, and it was sort of more fair than other approaches. And I think in some industries that makes a lot more sense than others. But when we talk about the life sciences and like achieving the vision of the FAIR principles and things beyond that, a lot of those choices, things that may end up as standards eventually, need to happen by the smallest group possible, the most specific domain and field and subdomain and subfield who cares about that topic should be making some of those decisions about minimal metadata, what is required, what must be done, and what's optional. And there are going to be concerns that you should find also across areas within the same domain or across domains, right? And we should have commonalities there when we can, but we need to let those things that are specific be specific. So that's where we've seen, due to this need and similar needs, we've seen the rise of community-based standards. So things that start as ad hoc agreements between friends and collaborators that eventually get maybe more or less formalized, but may never be so-called officially published as a standard, whatever that means. As a reminder to everybody, right, a standard is just an announcement of an agreement that was made, that this thing has a name, and when we use that name, this is what we mean by that name. And standards are also a marketplace. So there's many standards for screws. There's not the one standard for screw. We have many different types of standards, many different types of screws, and they all have different standards, and that's okay. We know when we use the name for that type of screw, we mean this specific concept. So standards aren't necessarily about saying this is the one way to do something, but then if we're doing that thing, we're using that name. That's what we mean by it. So I think it's also important to remind ourselves that standards can be a marketplace. So, for example, in the U.S., NIST is going to be good for a very broad standard that's very fundamental. What do we mean by different protocols for encryption? You want to have a very specific meaning there. And they don't have the capacity to support community standards. And I think actually it's going to be a real interesting challenge for the life sciences in all domains is to help these community standards, data standards, could be computational standards. And because you really want to be lightweight, especially at the beginning, let those groups figure out their norms, how they want to work together, what their goals are. But also at some point we need to help sustain these once they get stable and people kind of want to move on, but you need some institution around paying attention and release a new version or fix a typo. So I think the standards landscape is getting quite interesting. And then we have additional complexities. The old school style of standards is closed. Now you may have heard me make that distinction. CBL is an open and free standard. But classically, standards require money to participate, money to purchase. Now the PDF, of course, you know, famously, you pay the same number of Swiss francs for the PDF of an ISO standard as for the printed version. And it reflects a similar funding challenge we've had about the literature and delivering services in research. These things need to be free at the time of use. They need to be free to participate. we cannot have barriers to participation standards. It's hard enough to convince people to participate. But we still need to fund the institutions making these. So we have a similar sustainability challenge there. So NIST and NIH and NSF and other research funders and standards makers in the US are caring about this more, but they also see this challenge, just like we have in Europe and the rest of the world, the sort of long tail of community standards and balancing all of these. So I didn't really answer your question because it's, I guess my point is, I think the standards world is kind of evolving. I'm really excited. I want to see more open standards, open source standards as well. IEEE is experimenting with open source standards. I was for a while on their committee for that. I'm really excited about that change. A very huge institutional change. A very old standards organization trying to do open source and standards. And I'm really excited to see them continue that. And that's going to be a great fit for some standards. I worked in a standard, the BioCompute Object, now known as IEEE 2791. And that actually was, you know, initially promoted by the U.S. federal government, the Food and Drug Administration, and now adopted. So it's nice to see even traditional structures like that paying for the creation of an open standard that even went through a traditional route, but still remained, you know, at least the core of it is open source.
Do you see any are there any examples of that in NIH, NSF, or NIST?
I'm not so familiar with NIST, so I won't talk about them. NIH and NSF definitely care about standards and interoperability, and they funded many efforts related to that, including people who did contribute to CWL. And there are NIH-funded systems that implement CWL. Personally, I'm concerned at the amount of proprietary software paid for in the U.S. But, you know, I can't solve that problem. And I'm happy to see a stronger commitment to funding open source infrastructure in Europe. We still need to figure out what is that long-term sustainability story for these infrastructures. But I am not seeing a clear story from anybody about the standards. How are we going to maintain these standards? And for us, we went through this. We made a community standard. It was some people on a mailing list and a Google Drive and weekly meetings. And we knew we needed some more structure around us. We were hoping to find a standards organization that would be a fit, that would allow us to run openly and freely, not require payment to participate or payment to read. And we couldn't find a standards organization that met those needs. You know, life has changed in the last 10 years, but even then, I don't know where to send somebody who says, okay, I've got this community standard, but we need an institution for it to live on. So I think there's a really big need there. I don't think it's going to be one institution. We'll figure out what that looks like. Hopefully there'll be many solutions to this. And, you know, standards should also live and die, right? They don't need to live forever. This is not a infinite commitment to maintain these. But we should also help groups start standards efforts, these community efforts, because that's how we will achieve that. The FAIR will happen in two ways. It will happen because things become automated and invisible, and it will happen by enabling the most specific groups of people to make decisions about what the FAIR principles mean to their domain. So these two things are key. Automated stuff, because we can't ask people to do more things. They're too busy. But we also need to, it cannot be a central committee. We have to support the most specific communities that make sense to make those core decisions. Hopefully by reusing and composing many different standards and then adding their most specific stuff on top.
Okay, well, that's all really, really interesting. It's also a perfect segue into what's going to be my final question, and also picking up on one of the points which you just kind of touched on earlier, which is the relationship between FAIR as it relates to software and data, and you were talking about linked data. So kind of following on what you just said about those really interesting points about what will really enable FAIR to take off, we have talked a little bit about data in the course of the conversation, but it's mostly been about software and workflows. So could you talk a little bit more about how the whole linked data concept and how that relates to FAIR, how that comes into your thinking with the work that you're doing?
Yep. In CWL, we have a couple connections with linked data. One is in the object model, so how we present the system to implementers, where a piece of data is a file, is to us a location, an identifier, to really encourage implementers to take advantage of data being in multiple locations, to remember that data had a story. Maybe you just picked it up on disk, but maybe it came from a system. Maybe that location is actually an identifier, and we can connect that provenance in. Another source of linked data in this Common Workflow Language Standards is how we also talk about file formats. It's not required for workflow language to know about file formats, but it's good to check that connectivity, that these tools, you know, what you're producing is the format expected over here. And we don't specify a file format, you know, a list of file formats, a vocabulary. We say, go bring your own. So go use an internet standard. So there's the IANA media types, sometimes known as MIME types. You can use that for your file formats, but most scientific file formats are not represented in that list of file formats. So in biology and bioinformatics, we have the EDEM ontology. So for bioinformatics, we suggest people use the EDEM ontology for their list of file formats. But other domains should hopefully have their own sources of these identifiers. There are other places we can talk about linked data, which is like, you know, the software that you're using. Of course, please tell us which container you should use, but maybe also tell us which, you know, give us an identifier for the software. So if it's biology software, it's probably in the Elixir bio.tools registry. You can use that as an identifier, or an RRID from SciCrunch or somebody else. Any identifier source. In CWL, it's just a URL, it's a string. But we tell our implementers, you know, that you can get extra information from this, especially in the provenance tracking. In the larger story of provenance and workflows is, of course, knowing where your inputs came from and passing that information along to the recipient of your outputs. And so, you know, FAIR, you know, we know better these days about FAIR for data. Now we're getting good about FAIR for work, for software. And for workflows, we have both aspects to it. We have that FAIR for data aspect for the workflow description itself. So we should know about who did it, who is involved. But we also have the software aspect that we're referring to tools and descriptions of tools. And then there's the enactment of the workflow, which is definitely like software. And we need fairness around that enactment, recording what happened, and FAIR connections to that system. So workflows touch a lot, and in FAIR, they touch all these different aspects as well. And it's a nice place to also combine different FAIR efforts to see how they work end to end.
Well, that was brilliant. You've tied it all together with seriously. That was it's been a fascinating half hour for me learning about this, and also as I really do think your last statement kind of really shows to people who aren't probably involved in workflows that directly kind of how relevant it is to the things they probably are involved in, either the data or the software. So fantastic. Thank you. Thank you so much for what's been a fascinating conversation.
Oh, thank you so much, Rory. This was a lot of fun for me.
Okay, great. Well, that's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed the discussion. The FAIR Data Podcast is provided by fairdatapodcast.org and produced by Mehroz Ahmed. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts, and follow us on Twitter at FAIR Data Podcast. New episodes are released every other Wednesday, at 8 a.m. Pacific, 11 a.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. UK, 5 p.m. Central European Time, and late in Asia Pacific. See you next time.